Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me, as always, is my co-host and fellow philosopher, Michael Walker. How are you, Walker?
Hello.
And I am your other co-host, Mark Bigney, and I just want to issue some very important follow-up from last time. Oh. I commented that the last time that I had checked that the vocation of man, strictly speaking, the vocation of humankind, but it's translated as the vocation of man. I apologize for the gendered language sincerely. I don't like using it. I actually call the computer game No Person Sky because I'm not a fan of the title to use gendered language. But anyway, I commented by Johann Gottlieb Fichte that it was out of print. Sure enough, there's a new glorious-looking mediocre translation in hardcover that is in print. I have ordered it. This is important follow-up. We were inundated with zeros of messages about the importance of getting the vocation of man back into my library in a more robust way.
I'm sure you got the last one because, you know, swag moves books and, you know... Sold out.
Yes, exactly. We exert so much influence over the market of anything we discuss. That is why the Fast and the Furious franchise makes so much money.
It's true.
That is why people cannot find copies of The Vocation of Man. And that is why decks of playing cards are out of stock in every gas station and convenience store across the land because they're all being used for regicide. So, as mentioned, this is a board gaming podcast about board games. We're going to talk about what we reviewed last year, the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then we are going to talk about our topic, which is our favorite mechanisms. We have limited ourselves to three. This isn't even really a top three, but just three of our favorite mechanisms each.
Our latest whims.
Yes, exactly. Whatever happens in passing through our fevered minds at the time in question. So, Walker, what did we review last year?
It's timely, Mark, because I played it on BGA. It's A Wonderful World Kingdom. This is the two-player version of It's a Wonderful World.
I believe it's just called It's a Wonderful Kingdom.
It's a Wonderful Kingdom.
We reviewed both. In gotcha. The segment that we are talking about, both It's a Wonderful World, which is the multiplayer drafting game,
which is good,
and It's a Wonderful Kingdom, which is the two-player drafting game,
which is painful.
Yes,
like, so I got invited to the game.
Okay,
and the
cards... who is this person that hates you so?
Warm Boy.
Oh, of course.
And the cards come up, and I'm immediately uncaring. Like it was immediate. Like usually I went. And it's like this constant draft right from the beginning.
Yes.
It's just like, put a card in group one or group two, because, you know, you're sort of making these pools of cards in the two-player version. Are you going to trap it or are you not going to trap it? Ooh, a trap. And immediately did not care. The difference between the two is like night and day.
I frankly don't even remember much about It's a Wonderful Kingdom. We haven't revisited it since. But it's by the same designer, namely Frédéric Guérard, and by the same publisher, La Boîte de Jeux. And nominally, they're both drafting games, kind of, but they do different kinds of drafts. And It's a Wonderful World has this wonderful timing element, a lovely bit of tension about what to do with your cards. And the economy is very simple, but nonetheless introduces some difficult choices to make. And it's just breezy and fun and visually exciting. And I remember It's a Wonderful Kingdom being none of those things.
Yeah, well, the core, all those core mechanisms there, but just every round starts with this, you know, constantly back and forth of creating these pools, picking a pool.
Yes.
Create the pools again, pick a pool until you have X number of cards. And then you get to have, you know, the fun.
Very... Very interesting that you revisited. I've barely even thought about it, but It's a Wonderful World has gotten back to the table several times because it is one of my seriously all-time favorite games to bring when I have no idea how much gaming competency or literacy the people at the table have. You know, I want to play a hobbyist game, and there are going to be some serious hobbyists there, and I want to bring something that isn't a dexterity game that I think I can teach to pretty much anybody at any level of rules processing, because it really is that simple, because, you know, just take the card you want. It can just hit the table for free. You're never going to be able to build it, and that's fine, but you still have all this stuff that you can lay in, and it's just right in front of you, and you're like, oh, okay, I want gray cubes. I want gray cubes because I want to build this thing. How can I get out the gray cubes? And even whether you build it or not, it provides a degree of focus. I've had tremendous success getting people to play It's a Wonderful World when, you know, they want to play a hobbyist game, but I can tell they're not really up to jumping in the deep end, which is fine, and it's good to have those kinds of things in your toolkit. And I enjoy it, and I'm pretty deep in the hobby, evidently, and a whole bunch of other more serious hobbyists get it, and it plays up to seven. And best of all, it's another bulwark against having to play Seven Wonders.
Yeah, another fantastic sort of stepping economy that I love.
Yes.
It's not going to be in my three that I'm about to talk to, but it almost made it.
Well, broadly speaking, you know, timing considerations are, it's not so much a mechanism as a thing that I enjoy in games if they're done well. Not in the sort of laborious, it's like, well, in order to get the gears, first you need to get the permit for the gears, and then you need to go get the money for the gears, and then you need to buy the gears, and then you need to store the gears. Which sometimes can be okay, but sometimes can just be painful.
Are you saying that the gears are already made?
My apologies.
Well, gotta get the metal to make the gears.
Fair enough, but I don't have the permit for the metal. Anyway.
Well, you don't have the permit for the mine to get the steel for the... So,
so that is It's a Wonderful World and It's a Wonderful Kingdom by Frédéric Erard. It's a Wonderful World, highly recommended. It's a Wonderful Kingdom, no thank you, Warm Boy.
Just so.
I think that'd be a pretty good t-shirt. No thank you, Warm Boy.
No thank you, Warm Boy. Yeah, straight up that. Yeah.
That works. Yeah. So, Walker, what'd you play last week?
Mark, I got to play Orleans Plague. I got this expansion a few weeks ago.
Orleans is a plague.
We finally got it to the table. It was a problem getting it to the table.
Why is that?
Because of component issues.
Oh, you see,
I have the Board Game Geek bits, and that's all I have. So, therefore, the DLP expansion is completely incompatible, because what Orleans
is cardboard workers.
Yeah, what Orleans is a bag builder, and you're putting corpses into your bag. So the expansion comes with corpses, but they come with cardboard corpses. So our fix was for Warm Boy to bring his TMG cardboard version.
Interesting.
Also, completely incompatible.
Oh,
the cardboard from the TMG is thicker and slightly smaller. We decided to just go with it.
We said
we're going to try to be as honest as possible.
Right.
Reach in and just grab a handful and let them fall and count them.
Wild. Away. Okay, yeah.
So, yeah. So, if you want the Orleans Plague expansion, at the moment, you can only get the new Capstone Orleans game.
This is the classic tale of...
Or the DLP game, yes.
So long as it's utterly consistent with the publishers you've had before. This is the classic problem of being an early adopter and or someone who customizes and, you know, you get the perfect storage solution and then they release more stuff. Thank you, Mage Knight. You have the upgraded bits and now the old bits don't match. Thank you, Orléans. Or you get the first edition so you get to have all of the misprints. Or... they publish the corrections, but only in the new printing that don't match the original one, which is a limited run. Thank you, much of what happened with Through the Ages. You know, it's just endless stories of this, but I'm glad you were able to get it to the table. What was your experience of Orléans Plague?
It was great. I do have some other fixes you could have. If you have this problem, other fixes are that you could play with two player, and you know when you play with less players, you have a whole bunch of citizens extra put aside.
That is
true. Because the pools are small. So you can put small stickers on all of those extra components, and they could be your corpses. Second fix is that I looked into it, and there are several Board Game Geek Up Bit things that use the same size, 5mm discs.
Oh.
And you could just order them. They'll be completely different, and you could just say they're corpses and add them to your
like, what kinds of things? I'm amused by this notion of other things subbing it for corpses.
Quacks at Quiglenburg have bits, and some of the spy games. They have geek bits for all sorts of different games.
Interesting.
So, I love it. There is... I meant to write this down. That's not compensation. What is it when you prepay for murders in the old days? It's like you pay the church, I want to murder somebody.
Oh, an indulgence.
Indulgence. So there's indulgences in this.
No, interesting how you jumped right to murders.
Well, you know.
It was strictly speaking
for
anything.
Sure it was.
Any sin. Generally speaking, the slightly more principled scurrilous merchants who sold these things in advance limited it to venial sins, not mortal sins. But, of course, the infamous ones like Johannes Tetzel near the end started selling for mortal sins.
And don't get me
and
wrong.
Strictly speaking, I just want to stand up for the Roman Church, all right? Just let me stand up for... In theory, indulgences are not supposed to be issued in advance. That was just a practice that rose up in some less scrupulous vendors.
I think they're great.
Strictly speaking... Look, this is actually an important theological point. I find it fascinating. It's not supposed to be for money, and it's not supposed to be in advance. But during the lead up to the building of St. Peter, just before the Reformation, a number of people just started selling them for cash, and they would issue a blank certificate where you wrote in your name and your sin in it.
I think it's just great for history, because we wouldn't have hardly any of the great cathedrals we have now without this.
I don't know
this
if it funded most of the cathedrals. I don't think that's most of the cathedrals were funded by sales of it. Oh, yeah. Far too many. The number should be zero. But... anyway, go on.
All right. So, how the corpses work? They the events. There's a whole new event stack. It's a great expansion. I'm surprised when I opened it up and read through what you got. You got a whole new event stack, because that's usually the timer for the game. You get 18 events usually, so a whole new stack of different events. And you also have a indulgence deck of cards. And this is how you're going to get rid of these corpses. The events, you will put them in your deck, in your bag, and then the indulgences are all sorts of things, like take goods.
So you purchase an indulgence to get rid of corpses.
Well, no, you're more like just a I don't want to even say purchase, because it doesn't really cost you anything. You do have to take an action to get them.
Okay.
But
so
it's
you get
like
an indulgence,
you get an indulgence
that gets rid of the corpses.
Yes.
I'm confused about the notional.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's weird. Okay.
But anyway, so you draw them and they go into your market and they sit there. And then at the end of the turn, you can choose to remove them and just put them back in your bag. But then you have a chance of drawing them again.
Right.
Or you could just sort of have them clog up your market and then complete an indulgence. And it could be anything from move to a certain city or bring certain goods to a certain city or just discard certain goods. Anything you can think of in the game, there's a, build a guild hall somewhere. Anyway, anything. And then you simply get to clear all of the corpses that are in your market. And they're also worth victory points at the end. So that's kind of neat. You sort of start tucking them under your board. Also, there's a whole deck of sort of rat cards, and you're going to draw three of these at the beginning of the game, and they're just going to sort of change the whole game. So one of the ones we had was put a corpse in your bag right away. The other one was a right away thing. I've forgotten what it is already. And then one was for the whole game. If you decide to leave corpses in your market because you want to leave them there because you think you're going to do an indulgence next turn and you want to like get as many corpses in there as you can, but if you have any corpses in your market, you'd have to pay a dollar at the end of your turn. Ugh, brutal.
So anyway, you gotta pay wages with corpses, right?
That's true. So it plays much like normal Orleans other than that, except that the events are super punishing and your actions are painful. You also get a plague doctor, which is really awesome because he comes back to his spot at the end of every turn, and he is a super monk. If anyone, monks are wild, they can go to any spot, but only monks can go to monk's box, but plague doctors get to go wherever they want. So it's this wild token that you get to put for any action that you want. So sort of equals out when everything else is so, so punishing.
Now, normally you prefer your heroes to be slightly less punishing. What is it about the plague expansion to Orléans that pleases you so?
Well, I just think it's neat. It's a neat sort of bogging, like a curse system, you know, like other deck builders mm-hmm. or whatever, you know, how you get them out of your bag.
Oh, okay.
and the cycle.
So it's less just a flat cost and more just an interesting resource to manage. Okay, just interesting. So. And I do remember that one of my mild criticisms of Orléans was that the events were typically pretty boring. And so having a new stack of events seems appealing to me, at least.
Yeah, I thought it was neat. I'd play it again anytime, especially with this new expansion. You got some new buildings.
How accommodating would it be for new players?
I would not. If someone was New Orleans, I don't think I'd throw the play, because it is very punishing off the start.
Fair enough.
I'd let them have basic. And then it sort of limits your buildings too, which is too bad. I've never seen any of the other rule books do this, but then again, I don't think I've read them quite so thoroughly. It was just deal 10 level 1s and 10 level 2s. And when you have like a whole bunch, it's sort of like, it's like, but I have all these really cool, interesting buildings. I want to use them all.
I don't know. It seems like a rational response to the sheer number of promos that are available. Just don't use all of them. Just pick 10 of them.
So that was my experience with Orleans Plague. Really good.
Well, on the topic of corpses, I played Antiquity. Antiquity is the splatter game from 2004 by Jérôme Domain and Joris Versinga, like every other splatter game, nearly. And Antiquity is nominally about the late Middle Ages in Italy, but really there's not a whole lot of flavor going on. It's kind of like a city manager with slight trappings of some of your more non-confrontational civilizational elements, but mostly it's a question of resource depletion and disaster management, because all resources that you extract over the course of playing Antiquity represent your despoiling the wilderness. You need wood for almost everything. But once you cut down the trees, those trees are gone, Walker. There are no more trees to be cut down. But then you figure, oh, well, it's a field now, right?
That's weird. That's not how it works in nature, is it? There's lots of trees. They're endless, are they not?
Well, endless, but not in the scale of the course of playing a given game of Antiquity. And after you cut down the trees, there's a lovely field. You're, okay, well, maybe I'll tend some sheep there. I have some sheep. I'll start a sheep field. Well, the problem is that almost everything you do, they don't phrase it this way in Antiquity, but I'm going to peel behind the curtain and I'm going to tell you the truth. Everything poops, Walker. Everything poops. There's just poop everywhere. Everywhere, Walker.
It's all the way down.
Poop. It's all the way down. And eventually you run out of space for everything. You've exhausted the mining spaces. You've despoiled the wilderness. You've run out of places to dump your human waste.
So unrealistic.
And then you start wondering, my neighbor over there, that place where he wants to make a farm in a couple turns from now, I could put my poop there. And so you start expanding and encroaching. So Antiquity can be an incredibly confrontational game, even though there's no overt violence. And it's very much like other splatter games. It's the kind of thing where you can lock yourself out of the game. Fortunately, the rulebook is very clear about what you ought not to do, and that is don't run out of wood. And things that you really should do, which is build a couple of buildings early on in the game so you can interact with the field. But nonetheless, it is a series of daunting challenges that just keeps throwing you time after time. You have to make that push to find the new city. You have to make that push to find the new resources. You have to make that push to then start satisfying victory conditions. Another cool thing about Antiquity is that there are four possible victory conditions, and you only declare one of them once you build a cathedral that is devoted to a particular saint. And they're all extremely different. One of them is have your entire population out, and so there's a high food pressure there. Fortunately, that is the victory condition I typically end up pursuing because it rests rather saliently on the faculty of philosophy. Antiquity, one of Antiquity's many charms for me personally is that the faculty of philosophy is incredibly consequential and powerful. Many things in Antiquity require that you spend different kinds of resources. Like, for example, to expand your population, eventually you might have to start spending, you know, three different kinds of food, which is hard. But if you have the faculty of philosophy, you tell your philosophers, is there really any salient difference between a sheaf of wheat and a sheep? And they'll be able to come up with some argument as to why they're the same. And so you can then just ignore the difference requirement for things when you have a faculty of philosophy. Anyway, this is just one example of one of the many buildings, a whole bunch of different buildings with a whole bunch of special powers that are all cleanly and neatly articulated on the player aid sheet. But then you run out of space in your city, so now you have to find a new city. But now your pollution concerns are higher too, and you still haven't found any more room. In fact, building the city made you run out of room, and it's a whole thing.
You totally gave away one of my future mechanisms, area poop control.
Antiquity is great. Antiquity was the first splatter game I played where I really felt everything sing. I had tried Roads and Boats, wasn't really my taste. Indonesia is kind of interesting, but a little weird, and I'm not a huge fan of Pick Up and Deliver, and that's largely what Indonesia is about. And then I tried Antiquity, and I'm like, yes, this is the kind of Euro I like. Simple rules, lots of options, things go in lots of different ways. And so it's probably my second favorite splatter after the genius that is Food Chain Magnate. It and The Great Zimbabwe, I think, are kind of, depending on my mood, are my second favorite splatter game. And I highly recommend it. It's pretty long, especially for new players, because it's one of those games where, as I say, you declare your victory condition, and then you have to make a push towards it. And knowing when you're able to do that can be tricky. So first-time players sometimes is like 3 hours if you don't know what you're doing, especially if you cross the tipping point and now you're just in a death spiral. Because I promised corpses, Walker, what happens when you run out of room for poop? Well, then you have to start putting gravestones in your city. Didn't I say that there wasn't enough room in your city? There isn't. Now there's a gravestone in your faculty of philosophy. Dead philosophers can't think, Walker, because they don't got no souls. And now your faculty of philosophy doesn't work anymore. So now you can't increase your population anymore. And have your pollution concerns gone down? No, because people keep pooping. Anyway.
So much poop.
Antiquity is a marvelous game. It's very expensive. It's pretty fiddly. You've got to put out all those little desperation counters. Fortunately, though, as time has gone on, Antiquity has become less expensive and the components have gotten better. Like, for example, in the original edition, everything was just chits, these tiny little chits. And so to start a farm, you'd need to put out possibly like 12 chits out on the map, stacked on top of each other. Now, the pollution is represented by black plastic discs, which are easier to manipulate, easier to see, and so that's cut things down a little bit. And yeah, you could shave some corners, but still, time-consuming, expensive, but lots of freedom, lots of interesting challenges, lots of flavor. And frankly, one of the reasons why I was playing Antiquity was because the person I was playing with said, "Do you have any games that talk?" He didn't put it this way, but the way I interpreted it falsely was, "Do you have any games that grapple seriously with things like resource depletion?" And the answer for most games is no. There's always more resources to be had. The price may go up or something to that effect, but in terms of like actually grappling with scarcity and the kind of death spiral you end up with by virtue of pollution and resource scarcity. Antiquity, I think, is relatively alone, and so I was more than happy to return to it. Anyway, that is Antiquity, published by Splotter in 2004. One of my favorites.
Mark, we had an event this week that we had seven of us at a table. So we had some interesting games played. One of them was Just One. This is designed by Ludwig Rode and Bruno Salter and put up by Repos Production. And it is a game where one person has to pick a word, but they don't know the word. They choose a number and everyone gets to see what word it is. It could be like safe. And then everyone writes down a word that associates safe. They're trying to get the person to say safe. But what they don't want to do is have the same clue as anyone else at the table, because they reveal all their clues to each other, and any clues that are identical get to be flipped down.
So there's an impetus to think of something that other people haven't thought of, which is how you end up with someone writing camera as a clue for elf. Elf for camera, camera for elf. I'm still thinking about that.
We got a man on that. We'll get back to
Top Gibbon.
But when you get a fantastic clue, like from the Wandering Battery, when it's safe and he writes down cracker and he pulls it all together, like you're down to just three words.
Yep.
And you have great words like cracker that are like totally out of the box, but we'll bring it in with the other words. That's where Just One just sings.
It's true. We're huge fans of Just One. We had to do something that we've never done before. And this is honestly, the more I've been thinking about it, the more I think it's quite difficult to explain or understand. We binned a clue for the first time ever, a response.
It's true.
And that is, one of them was Israel. And, well, why? Because here's the thing, and I mean this sincerely. Sometimes party games think, oh, well, you know, we need a whole bunch of clues, we need a whole bunch of responses. Oh, well, names of countries, let's put them in. First of all, I would argue that if you don't want there to be potentially some very difficult conversations or giving people the opportunity to be irresponsible edgelords, you don't want to do that. And basically, whether it's Israel or any other country, most of the time that's just an invitation for bad stereotyping, right?
Yes.
In the case of Israel, it's especially fraught. So how did that end up there? One person at the table asked, when was this published? To which my response was, does it matter? Anyway. Mysterious. I don't know why they put that in there.
It was rough. But other than that, fantastic round of Just One.
Oh, it was a very good session, yes.
Also, fantastic session of Green Team Wins. This is designed by Nathan Thornton and put out by 25th Century Games. We had some fantastic questions like, which of the seven dwarves would do great in a dating game?
Yes, the three in question were Grumpy, Dopey, and Bashful.
I thought it was a fantastic question.
It was an interesting question. And another question that I liked, which I would have actually liked for a little bit more discussion, was which of the following three sleep states do you think are ideal? Window open, under heavy blankets, or fresh sheets? I was team fresh sheets, largely because pretty much whatever climate you're in, there are circumstances where you definitely don't want the heavy blankets or the open window. But fresh sheets are great all the time. But apparently no. Apparently that was some solid orange team energy. And then green team, they pulled my shirt over my head. They started pummeling me, and then they gave me a swirly. It was not pleasant. But that's how green team rolls.
I was about to say that's how green team rolls.
If I were on the green team, I'd understand.
Exactly. Another game we played was Quest. This is designed by Don Eskridge and put out by Indie Boards and Cards.
Same designer and same publisher as The Resistance.
So guess what? It's a hidden role game, but it has some very interesting things, especially like endgame, sort of a single member of a team gets to make a call. Do I try to guess exactly who two people are on the other team, like their role exactly, or do I just not say anything and hope that they can't point out all of the other team?
Right. It's weird because in my head, Quest is a simpler version of The Resistance. This is not accurate. In terms of actual rules, it's slightly more intricate. The way in which Quest is a more approachable version of The Resistance is that it is much, much less intense. Much less talking, much less logic puzzle, much less you are under a spotlight, explain your reasoning. which are, now to be fair, those are some of my favorite elements of the Resistance, but it's one of the reasons why I recognize it's not for everybody. Not a lot of people want to engage in sometimes, not always, you know, the 90-minute long, grueling, but in my experience, exhilarating sessions of the Resistance where these nested conditionals and trying to figure out the logic puzzle. Because in Quest, for example, there's no voting. You never, ever vote on anything. The leader just decides who's going on a mission. And the leader also decides who the next leader is. So there's that. And those are the elements that make me misidentify it as simpler, when in fact I just meant less intense, less stressful, more approachable, even though more complex. And thus, it was something I thought I'd put in front of you to see how you'd react, because you generally do not like social deduction games. And I was surprised that you seem to enjoy it more than a lot of the others. Yeah. I don't know about how far that gets you.
Well, I just think there was a way to get actual information. And therefore, you could sort of suss out what was actually going on, as opposed to just making blind assumptions.
Okay, well, I would push back on that, but sure. I'm glad you were a...
And it's so short. Like, I can see, I understand the Resistance. Like you said, logic puzzle. Yeah. And through hours of, you know, missions and whatever,
something is
going to strain itself out, and you're going to think, this was, you could get it in, I think you could get Quest in 30 minutes. I really do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And for that 30 minutes, I really think it shines and does what it needs to do.
It also, another virtue that it has, and again, this isn't necessarily something I'm looking for in a social deduction game, is that you're going to have more special roles. And the system's not going to creak under the weight of those special rules. For example, some people who play Werewolf, they love loading in. Like, almost everybody is a weird non-villager or a weird special kind of werewolf. That's not how I like to play social deduction games. In fact, I prefer normal Resistance to Avalon. I don't like special roles as a rule. But I will say that Quest integrates them really, really, really well. They're relatively straightforward, and most of them just interact with the information space in a relatively clean way. Like, for example, another innovation in Quest is the leader gets to magic somebody. And when you're magicked, you cannot throw a failure, even if you're one of the bad guys. There are two exceptions. One of them is Morgan Le Fay. Morgan Le Fay can always throw a failure if she wants to. She's just unaffected by magic. More damning is the role that I was. I was the youth, or Ute, as certain defense attorneys might say. And the Ute, when magicked, must play a failure. Normally good guys can't fail missions, but the youth, when magicked, is obliged. And so on the first mission, I was magicked. It was great. Nobody trusted me. Nobody should have trusted me. I was completely wrong about the information safe by the end of Quest. I misparsed everything. But nonetheless, I see why I made the mistakes that I made, and I had a good time. I vastly prefer the Resistance, but I'm glad that you found quests tolerable, mildly enjoyable. How far are we going?
I'd say mildly enjoyable.
Mildly enjoyable. There we go. Looking
forward to playing again.
I will take that win.
There you go.
Now, it's important to note that as published, Quest was mucked about by the publisher in ways that are borderline degenerate. And so the recommended way to play Quest is with the director's cut. Because there's a whole bunch of different setups you can use. Like, as I mentioned, there are a whole bunch of different special roles. You can include a different subset of them. Some setups are, as I say, borderline degenerate. Use the director's cut. It's my preferred way to play. It's what I recommend. Quest. Good luck finding it on BoardGameGeek. Enter Quest and you'll get 10 million results. Just look for Don Eskridge as the designer. If you're trying to find it somewhere, just do Quest Don Eskridge. You'll be able to find it. Got to play Sidereal Confluence. My dear friend Josephus was in town, and he came to me with but one request. He said, Mark, your company I will tolerate, but really what I would like to do is play a game of Sidereal Confluence. He also mentioned wanting to play Envelopes of Cash, which doesn't surprise me. There was a memorable time, about a year ago, actually, where Josephus explained to me the BCS system in NCAA. It was about 45 minutes long, the explanation, and I seriously, this isn't a bit, this isn't a joke, I felt my sanity leaving me as he was explaining all these weird conditions and systems of bowls and weird computer calls and deciding that the undefeated team is actually not as good as the team that lost a couple times. And anyway, setting all that aside, we did get to play Sidereal Confluence. It was a 6-player game with a couple new players, but it went really, really well. One of the new players really wanted to play the Zeth, and the Zeth are the ones who run a protection racket. I was a little concerned, and I was, not because I had any doubts about the player, but it's just like, are you sure that's what you want to do? And she's like, oh yeah, this is what I want. And she read the advice. There's a helpful sort of advice panel in the revised edition of Sidereal Confluence, and it said, be rude. And she took that to heart, and it was glorious. Nice. It was genuinely glorious. She would sidle up with these terrible deals. And then, and I'm like, no, that's a bad deal. And here I was as the rules explainer wanting to, like, does she not understand the fundamental nature of the economy? Does she not understand what this is worth as opposed to that? And then she'd, like, look down at her protection racket tokens and be like, oh, okay. And I'm like, crap, she knows exactly what she's doing. This is terrible.
All right, then, you don't want to trade? Well, let me just...
Yeah, it was more or less like that. It was wonderful. And I got to play as the Kitzer Kitriddle, who are the insects, as I mention every time. There's so much flavor in the different factions in Citadel Confluence. One of the elements that's great is that the Kitzer Kitriddle have a spatial notion of responsibility rather than causal, i.e. they don't care who caused the problem. Whoever is closest physically to the problem when it happens, it is their responsibility to fix it. So that's an interesting notion. So in other words, if you want to kill somebody, get a sniper rifle, you'll probably get off. Anyway, it is a marvelous negotiation game, everyone. A number of people have the same response, which is, I don't really like negotiating in a lot of other games, but this felt great because it doesn't really feel like you're negotiating. I'm like, yeah, because you're not haggling. You don't haggle in Citadel Confluence. If you're haggling, you're losing, broadly speaking. There's some exceptions. High-stakes trades, that one big multivariant trade where I trade you a converter and the next turn you trade me a different converter and half the goods to run it, the other half come from this person, and then the research team triggers. That, yeah, you might want to iron out the small details. But if you don't want to trade the green for the brown, best to move on. And consequently, I'm always, always, always happy to play Citadel Confluence. It doesn't feel as draining as a lot of other multi-hour negotiation games feel. The example I always give is New Angeles. I quite enjoyed my one playing of New Angeles. 3 hours of negotiation, but I felt tired. I needed a nap at the end. I needed to be alone in a dark room with my feelings. But Citadel Confluence, marvelous game. Love the theming. Love the integration, love the asymmetry. It is one of my favorite games. And I keep coming back to the notion that in the same year in this hobby, Walker, we got Guards of Atlantis, Gloomhaven, Spirit Island, and Citadel Confluence. I know you're not huge boosters of all of those, but oh my goodness, are we ever going to have a year like that again?
It's a good year.
Yeah, it was a great year. So, Citadel Confluence by Tau Ceti Dykeman, published by WizKids in 2017. There was a revised edition later on. I even brought the expansion, but I didn't want to play with the expansion because ultimately, if there's a player there that's sufficiently experienced to play the expansion, fine, they can go play an expansion faction. And I keep thinking that I want to play an expansion faction, but after I've done setting up the game and setting up all the factions and explaining to everybody the rules and all other individual factions work, do I then feel like busting out the separate box, the other components, and then learning a new faction for the first time? No.
That's the same thing I had with when I was playing Dune Uprising. It was like, oh, I really want to play one of these like funky factions that have like little side rules that you do. And then, you know, after I, you know, it's like, no, I'll play this one star faction.
Yeah, exactly. So that was Citadel Confluence. Great time was had by all. Totally made Josephus willing to suffer my company.
Mark, we got to play Fast Sloths. This doesn't even make sense. This is a Friedman.
No, it makes perfect sense.
This is Friedman Freeze, designed by F2 Spiel.
You've got a Fast Sloth. I've got a board game that can take us there.
Just so.
You want to hear a rumor that I think is pretty credible because I just made it up?
Yes.
I think Luke Combs is going to follow up his award-winning performance with a song called Fast Sloths.
Nice. I believe that before you even said it. In Fast Sloths, it's a great game because it's easy to teach and you can play it in many different ways. You can try to deprive people of cards by emptying certain decks. You can move animals away. You can do all this player interaction if you wish, or you can just try to race your sloth around eating the leaves. There's a multitude of different animals and they all have special rules, and your sloth itself doesn't get to move. It is being carried by all these different types of animals that have limitations of what terrain types they're allowed to move in. So there's all this sort of board manipulation going on. Fantastic little game. I'd love to play it anytime. Fast Sloths.
It is a pick-up and deliver game where you do not pick anything up. You are the one being picked up. It is a race game where you do not move. And it's got a very efficient, tight rule set, but nonetheless a lot of variety. There's a whole bunch of different map setups that feel considerably different because there are these big choke points. Crossing water is difficult. Crossing mountains is difficult. Sometimes even an inopportune combination of meadows and hills can be very inconvenient based on the animals that are in play. The animals all feel different. All you need to do, and it's one of those games where there's a lot of variability in setup, but in Fast Sloths, it does actually feel different. You know, the rabbits feel very, very different from the alternative animal that you could do. The unicorn feels very different from the humans. And so even just changing one of those details does actually lead to considerable difference. And we looked at the other maps. One side of the map board that I've never used, I've only played twice, has an island, which, okay, that would be very different. And so I think Fast Law, this is a great example of Friedman Freeze at his best. He's an extremely talented and clever designer, and he's very good at making light rule sets that give you a lot of mileage. And one of the barriers you might have if you're involved in snooty hobbyists, as we sometimes are, I was surprised that Huey had this position, but nonetheless, it's one that he had. He, you know, very snootily thought, oh, is this a game for babies? Are we going to play a game for babies now, this baby game? It's like, no, this is really good. Yeah, it's got cartoony animals and cute sloths and everything, but it's a really neat pick-up-and-deliver game. Some clever decisions and some tempo considerations. Leave me alone, and why are you judging me? Big fan of Fast Sloths. I would like to see if I could track down some of the extra stuff. Like, there's a chameleon, there's an extra animal, and then there's some extra map boards, but it's reasonably out of print in various ways. So,
yeah, just like Fresh Fish. I really want to play Fresh Fish.
And that is Fast Sloths by Friedman Freeze.
I got Set a Watch back to the table. This is designed by Mike Grund and Todd Walsh, put up by Rock Manor Games. And it is sort of it's very much like Xenoshift. You have a group of four adventurers. You know that you're about to fight a bunch of monsters. One person has to stay to tend the fire. They have their own little set of actions that they do. Then the other three go out and fight this line of monsters. There's all sorts of reveal effects and move to the front of the line, move to the back of the line. You have all these different abilities you can use, but they're also your hit points. You have dice, and it's different per character. Some characters use D4s. Some use D8s.
D4s?
Yes.
D4s are gross.
They are gross, but Huey decided that he wanted to use the witch. That's the interesting part of Set a Watch. They do this very interesting balance of how strong your abilities are with which dice you have. Because you can just take the dice and put it on the monster, it does that much damage. And as you know, D4s aren't going to do that much, but the abilities...
Oh, they'll do a lot of damage if you step on them.
It's true. But the abilities that witch has, it's like just destroy, you know, put a D4 on this ability. Whatever slot that is, then that monster is just dead.
Okay, is the witch a good witch or a bad witch?
I don't know. But which one, though?
If they're a bad witch, I will accept that they use D4s.
Probably.
Okay.
She does pretty evil things.
Okay.
It's pretty rough.
Fair enough.
And they have a familiar, kind of neat. I enjoy Set a Watch. Lots of different characters. We use the new Merchant expansion that lets you buy items, which are very interesting as well. Great little game.
I should really try it. I'm very curious about the Set a Watch business. Played The Big Push, Trench Warfare on the Western Front in World War I. This is what happens when sometimes Board Game Geek decides that the subtitle needs to be part of the title, and we try to follow that convention. But anyway, so The Big Push. Played The Big Push. This is by Renaud Verlac, published by Holland Spiel. So Holland Spiel is a fascinating little publisher. Amabel Holland is a fascinating publisher and fascinating designer. And Renaud Verlac is the designer of two of the most prominent grand strategic two-player Napoleonic war games. And I'm a sucker for grand strategic Napoleonic war games. The last one he did, which he self-published and published through Gamecrafter, was Swords Around the Throne, and it was really, really interesting, extraordinarily well done, very evocative with a tight rule set. Had a little bit of the, well, these are subjugated miners and these are independent miners, and then the transition between the... For whatever reason, those distinctions tend to bust my head wide open in almost any kind of war game, including Napoleonic war games. But anyway, this is his incredibly simple, incredibly abstracted card game about trench warfare in World War I. Does it feel or look like trench warfare in World War I? No, not even remotely. Is it a two-player game of resource management? Yes. And... there were some interesting things. One of the things, and I guess this is somewhat historically evocative, both sides, the Entente player and the German player, have a deck of six innovations. And it's the same innovation. You draw one at the start of each of the five turns. So one of them you're just not going to see. They both have the same deck, but the order in which they draw them will be different. And the first turn when you deploy them, if you've deployed them for the first time in the game, you get a massive bonus for that round. It's like, oh, we've never seen tanks before. This is a bad scene, or the like. And consequently, you have this strange asymmetry that develops, despite the fact that you both have the same deck.
Yeah.
And that part was very interesting. However, it led to one of the big downsides in terms of actually playing The Big Push, which is there's an endless concatenating series of modifiers that you always have to be applying. It's kind of a tug of war game. It's like, okay, well, now we're resolving Verdun. And in Verdun, okay, I'm revealing two armies, one with a strength 5, one with a strength 9. Okay, I invented tanks last round, so I get a +1 to both of those. You, however, have defense and death, and you invented it this round, so the +2 applies there. And you've played mud, which gives a -1 to each of my, etc. And so it's like, okay, 15 to 12. Okay, now it's 11 to 12, or is it, okay, now you play a card in response. So it's a little difficult to resolve. And frankly, when you spend so much of your time in this back and forth of shoving a number up and down, I would much rather be playing something like Blitzkrieg by Paolo Mori, which does something vaguely similar, but has more interesting timing considerations with respect to the different fronts as they're resolved, or something like Land, Air, and Sea by John Perry, which has this similar vibe of, you know, a two-player card game where you're fighting over fronts.
I have a feeling that a statement of this would be better as a computer game was uttered, maybe.
It was. It was, because I was playing with Josephus, and Josephus has a very low threshold for wanting to rather play things as computer
constant
games.
Modifiers.
But in this case, I absolutely felt where he was, understood where he was coming from by virtue of these numbers. So it was interesting in the way that it implements some of its mechanisms. It was interesting insofar as it had an implied thesis about technological development in warfare, but past that, I thought it wasn't as tight or as interesting as his other designs, despite the fact that it was only about 90 minutes, but it kind of felt like a much ado about nothing. It was an interesting experiment. I don't know that it would have many legs, because the biggest damning factor, I think, for what was going on in the big push is you are going to do well on the turns when you have more cards than the opponent. Now, how you get to more cards than the opponent is kind of interesting in terms of its evocation of historicity. The Eastern Front might be eating up German supplies. U-boat warfare might be eating up German supplies. The blockade will eat... Anyway, that will all determine it. But I really did feel like on the turns I did well were the turns where I had more cards. And the turns where I didn't do well were the cards I didn't have more cards. And there's not a whole lot of decision space about how to get to more or less cards. So at the end of the day, I felt that it was mostly like I was just going through the motions of tallying modifiers, which is not the most compelling gameplay experience, even though it had a little bit of historical texture and a little bit of historical flavor. So that was the big push. Trench Warfare on the Western Front in World War I by Renaud Verlac. I do recommend Age of Napoleon to a certain extent and Swords Around the Throne, his Napoleonic stuff. But this was published by Hollenspiel in 2017.
Lastly for me, Robinson Crusoe. After 4 years in crowdfunding hell, it is here, Mark.
I don't believe you.
And it was played.
No, I don't believe you.
Now, what does this new collector's edition have? Well, it has figures. Before, you had the little discs to put out
your... Unplayable!
Now you have four different figures. Because they have two figures, because you have two sides of your... You could play this adventure, you could play this explorer, or this cook, or that cook.
I see.
And because you have pawns, they have two pawns for each one. So a lot of figures that are a little overly necessary, but that's okay. You also get this giant miniature for your camp. And so you put out a little thing, and then if you build up your camp, like, in-game, then you get to put out more. So you could visually see where your camp is, and you could also look over at the board to see.
How much toy factor do you have for building up your little camp?
Oh, it's tons. It looks really cool.
Really cool. Good. Okay, I'm glad.
The other thing I love about and hate about it is the fact that it comes with two books. Well, it comes with many... Sorry. There are two books.
Word papers make me mad.
That are not the rule book. So yes. We have two other books. One is, and they're both to do with the starting campaign, it's called. And this would be fantastic for me if I had never played it, because it does walk you right through it. It has a spiral-bound book, which I love, and you're playing on the book. It says, place these tiles here. Open up this. It even has its own starting deck that will be cards that you just put in the main game. So if you already know the game, you just open this up and just add the cards. But this is, and they're all in the right order. So
right,
as you're
right.
drawing them, you're putting them out, and you play through four scenarios, and it teaches you the whole game through these four scenarios. Unfortunately, it was... Play the first scenario, and it's like, oh, yes, now I remember. So I had, you know, it's like, but you know how you have two pawns. They only let you use one. It's like, but this doesn't make sense, and
right.
I want to do the whole game, and you're not letting me hunt, and I want to gather now. So, unfortunately, we just turbo through those four, and now we're ready. We're going to go to the full missions. It also comes with this giant spiral-bound mission book now. So there's all these different missions, and... It was back when I got neoprene mats. So there's this giant neoprene mat. It has a spot to put this book. So it's going to look fantastic.
Artists have their blue face. Walker had his neoprene face.
So we're going to stream it soon on the note about streaming back to Orleans Plague. That's the game we stream this week. So if you're interested at all, you can go check out our YouTube channel for that. But anyway, I'm sure this week we're going to stream the new Robinson Crusoe. Looking very much forward to playing a full game with all the death. Yeah, so you have to feed your people every day. There's weather that's going to hurt them. There's all these events that are going to happen when you go to try to either, you know, build your shelter so you don't get affected by weather, or gather food so you don't starve. On top of all this, you have to be doing the things you need to do to complete the mission.
Oh, sorry, that shelter you built? It's damaged.
It's
now.
Damaged. Yeah, so
you got to fix it.
So if you don't like games that constantly browbeat you, then this is not for you.
It's weird. This is two games now that are very much about punching you in the face that you've reported very positively about.
Oh, I just like that kind of. I love. And Frostpunk is so much like Robinson Crusoe, but even more in my wheelhouse because it's post-apocalyptic.
Right.
But I still like Robinson Crusoe just because it was the OG. That is Robinson Crusoe, designed by Joanna Kionka and Ignacy Tribicek, put out by Portal Game.
Finally for me, played Wabash Cannonball, played the 2023 Rio Grande Games edition of the John Boer game. Now that he's not publishing pseudonymously this game anymore. And the Rio Grande copy, again, is so ugly as to be kind of charming. It comes past out the other end, and it's kind of charming. I do appreciate the fact that it is a small box. The previous edition published by Queen, which was called Chicago Express, was kind of ostentatiously large. So the fact that this is a much more efficient and economical version is very much to be appreciated, because Wabash Cannonball is a very efficient and economical game. It was described, not inaccurately, by somebody who had never played a cube rails game before as 18XX Lite, which if anything is underselling it, because unlike an 18XX game, Wabash Cannonball will be done in about 45 minutes, but gets a lot of the same kind of economic cutthroat interaction. Another thing I love about Wabash Cannonball is that different games will evolve differently based both on the economic attitudes of the players involved as well as the various priorities that they have. So one of the big metrics is how many railroads reach Chicago. And we had an interesting game in which, number one, Red was owned exclusively by a single player, namely me. This is unusual for it to happen that way. I didn't even profit as much as you might think from that, because I bought the shares sufficiently cheaply that the railroad was then undercapitalized and just didn't have enough money to reach Chicago. I could have reached Chicago. No one would have been able to stop me because I was the only one invested in Red, but it didn't have enough money. Kind of petered out near Wheeling. Anyway, it was a nice constant source of income, but two different railroads hit Chicago, and that was interesting. One of them being the Wabash Cannonball that opened after the other railroad, Green in this case, ran smack into it. It was very interesting. At any rate, there was a series of lowball bids which left the economy very straight. Anyway, every economy of Wabash Cannonball will evolve differently. For people who kind of sort of like auctions and this kind of economic manipulation, but are scared away, I think, legitimately by some of the excesses of 18XX, Cube Rails games are where it's at, and I think that Wabash Cannonball is an excellent introduction to the genre. It and Irish Gauge, I think, are two of my favorite Cube Rails games. Really, really well done. And it was a joy to come back to it because, again, you might have your heuristics. You may have recollections about what things may or may not be worth, but the table gets to decide what things are worth. And apparently, a share of Red was worth around $10 in this game of Wabash Cannonball. So there you go. Strangeness ensues. That was Wabash Cannonball by John Boer, published by Rio Grande Games.
Those are the games we played this week. Now a quick pause while we pay some bills. And we're back. Now on for the news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, I talked about the Adventure Time role-playing game back. Maybe I talked about it on the show. I definitely talked about it on our Pledge of Indifference, where we talk about crowdfunding games. It is now live, so if you have any interest in adventuring in the land of Ooh, then now is your time. I'm going to do a pass, only because I did the Avatar role-playing game. Still sitting in the box. Don't regret getting it.
Right.
There will be a time for Avatar the role-playing game. It's just not yet.
Sure. It seems like a very strange tone to be able to manage for a role-playing
game.
A lot of pressure on the game master.
I was
going
to say, you'd have to have a very... I think you'd have to have an experienced game master in this type of situation.
Someone who knows the setting, who knows the tone, who can carry that off. That having been said, I don't really know a whole lot about Adventure Time. So, almost all my friends are huge into it. I mean, the number of people who won't shut up about bacon pancakes, it's just...
I am a big fan.
I know. So a couple of developments in the world of business. I don't really understand business very well. It's not really my thing, business. But nonetheless, I can sense big developments when they happen. The Embracer Group, which is the large capital group which owns Asmodee, has spun off Asmodee. Asmodee is now going to be its own thing. There are two very notable elements, though, of this spinning off. Number one, they've decided to offload a whole bunch of the company debt onto Asmodee. So whether that's going to negatively impact their operations remains to be seen, especially since this includes a lot of distribution. A lot of major distributors are owned by Asmodee and will continue to be owned by this independent operation that now has a whole bunch of operating debt. So who knows? I'm not saying it's about to go under. I'm just saying that things are afoot. Similarly, acquisitions that Asmodee might have been inclined to do the mood is spreading. It's a vibe that people want to get in on. And Goliath is living up to its name, not by turning into stone at the top of Xanatos's building during the daytime, but by acquiring Lucky Duck Games. And now, as a consequence of this acquisition, Goliath is now the third largest games producer in North America. So things are afoot as to what consequences this is going to have in the short term. Who knows?
A webbed foot, even.
Nice.
Yeah. And that was kind of odd. Lucky Duck, I find, is feels like a very large company. And for it to be sort of swallowed up seemed odd to me.
Well, a large company in the hobby gaming sphere.
Yeah.
That and 98 cents will get you a Snickers bar.
It's true. So, Mark, sometimes we have big problems when there's a game that has a ton of expansions and people don't know when to, you know, how to get in. Like, what do I buy? What's my entry point when there's multiple starter sets and so many expansions? Well, there is a game that you and I wanted to get into for so long, but now it comes in a big box. So we're lucky, man. Munchkin big box. Load off, one purchase, and we're done.
You got me.
And that's the news and why it really doesn't matter. Now on to the topic of the week, which is our top three at the moment interested in
some of our favorite mechanisms. The moment you start putting numbers on things, Walker, we don't need the superlative, and we don't. Oh, jeez. Would you like to go first? Shall we alternate, Walker? I'd be surprised, frankly, having made this list, if there's any overlap. But I'd be shocked. We have not compared notes.
It's true.
We're doing it live.
We are. All right. So I'm not drafting, but not normal drafting.
Not normal drafting.
When there's like all over the place weird things that you're drafting. Like we just did this in Galactic Renaissance. You do it at the beginning of the game.
Right.
You're drafting a card. You're drafting a planet. You're drafting your starting forces. You're choosing these different things. You do it in the fox experiment. You're drafting a male fox, a female fox, whether you want the first turn or not. You're doing it in Lunar Rush. You're doing different ships. I know they're very similar, their ships, but they're either coming or they're going, and the different speeds they are.
Oh, no, that matters a lot, yeah. So when there are multiple categories of things that you're drafting, they're all drafted at the same time, but you cannot draft a second of the individual thing. So sometimes you get to look around the table and say, well, Huey's already drafted a character, so I know I don't have to compete with him on that. Where a Sidewinder's already drafted to territory, I know I don't have to compete with her on that.
Yeah, and Gutenberg does the same sort of thing, where you're drafting a whole list of things, and you sort of look down that list and you just say, you're prioritizing. That is the thing I need this turn. The other things are important, but I need to draft that first. So you grab that, and then you're just going to have to adapt after that.
So what is it about that extra stage of having to draft from multiple different categories that really bumps it up for you?
I'm not 100% sure. I think it's just that part you already talked about where two people have already drafted that, so you don't really care about that, or the fact that you have to prioritize, you have to focus on what you need or look at the game state and say, well, nobody really wants gold.
Right.
And there's two gold there, so the fact that if someone offhandedly takes a gold, then there's still one there for you. So there's no way both gold are going to be gone.
Right.
Well, still, first two people take gold because they want to ruin your life and they hate you. But anyway, all of these different, you know, timing and double think considerations,
sure,
is what I like about these off weird drafts.
Sure. To a certain extent, you get a lot of those considerations about double think and you know, knowing that nobody wants it from a normal draft situation. But I do agree with you that there is something kind of fun when there are multiple different categories that you're drafting all at the same time. That is one of the things that I liked about the Fox experiment as well, even though ultimately it felt repetitive. So, I'm going to lead off with hand management. Hand management is one of my absolutely favorite mechanisms. It has been for a very, very long time. It's one that actually I think is at the root of some of the games that you and I do not agree on. There are some games that I really like that you don't, and you dismiss them as deck milling games, whereas I believe that a lot of the decision making comes through the hand management. I'm going to focus more on games we do actually agree on for what it is worth. So one of them actually is, we just talked about it this week, I forgot about how excellent it is in the hand management, that is Fast Sloths. The way Fast Sloths work is you do want to build up these large combos with existing animals and zoom all over the board, but every time you draw, so there's a limitation on the drawing, you can't draw more than one card of a given animal per turn. So consequently, you have to build it up. You have to look at the board and say, in two turns from now, I'm going to be in elephant land. So when that happens, I should have lots of elephants. So a few turns from now, you start building up the elephants, and therefore it influences your hand management in that way.
I love how there's like sort of two steps to that. Not only can you take the elephants in your hand, but you can just sort of take the elephant and even discard it, which will cycle the deck, which means in the following turns, they'll be more powerful.
Exactly. Other games of hand management that I think are brilliant. I mean, Reiner Knizia does hand management really, really well. No surprise. He does a lot of things really well in a lot of his games. Blue Moon is a game that is frequently derided as basically being a war ripoff in that you can either win the fight or you can't, and if you can win the fight, you win the fight, and that's it. That's how the entire game. But that completely ignores the fact that you have to marshal your resources, both in terms of your hand and in terms of your overall deck. So there's an element of management in that sense. Tigris and Euphrates, similarly, sometimes gets dismissed by people as either you have red or you don't. And if you've got the red, you win, and if you don't have the red, you don't. That, again, ignores the fact that there's hand management involved. You've got to be know when to push, know when to withdraw, know when to focus on what you've got.
Know when to cycle.
And honestly, a lot of games that are sometimes dismissed as too luck-heavy, I think are largely sometimes dismissed because people don't know how to marshal their resources and blow them at inopportune times. And now, some games are too luck-driven, but I think that a lot of games, when designed with care and craft, can use hand management and randomness in conjunction to offset the weaknesses of the other. And then finally, there's one hand management game that has no randomness insofar as managing your hand, and that is Gloomhaven. The hand management in Gloomhaven is so thoroughly brilliant. It's why I think the game is what it is. Without the hand management, yeah, the class variety and the special powers and the tactical combat, yeah. But honestly,
The story, Mark.
No. The hand management is really what I think makes Gloomhaven sing more than any other single element. By virtue of the cycling involved and knowing when to rest and knowing when to use which side of which ability and marshaling those resources. I love hand management games. When done well, it is one of my absolute favorite mechanisms.
Next up for me is customizable tableau.
Tableaux. Yeah. Learn how to speak.
Learn how to speak French.
Yeah, good.
I'm sure they don't know.
Tableaux.
People won't know what I'm talking about if I don't call it the right thing, Mark.
Don't confuse them. There's an X at the end. It's tableaux.
So, what's going to make your gameplay slightly different from everywhere else and everyone else at the table? And you can customize that constantly throughout the game. Like Hansa Teutonica, you are unlocking parts of your player board, which is letting you take more actions or more stuff. There's Cryo, which is every time you pull your guys back, you're running through these lines that you've customized yourself. Scythe, not only are your factions different, but you're unlocking stuff differently than everyone else. And then Crusaders, it is a rondel that you get to customize in many different ways. Crusaders are going to come up again for my next one. That's probably why I like Crusaders so much, as two of my favorite mechanisms.
Yeah, I think customizing your board in this way, or your tableau, or whatever, you sometimes use board tableau when I say board, that's fine, whatever, is, I think, preferable when done well to just standard variable player powers. I mean, yeah, I like variety and I like variable player powers, but the ability to fine-tune something like that in that way tends to be a little bit more constrained, but at the same time give you a little bit more control. I think Cryo is a good example of that, where especially since I enjoy managing the board in games of Hansa Teutonica. There, though, they're just strictly upgrades. Like, you decide what you focus on, and of course, my board may be strong in one area and weak in another. But in the case of Cryo, it really is like, build an economy. Decide how you want this to work. Get it tuned to the way you want. Yeah. So somewhat relatedly, I believe someone said rondel. Did someone say rondel?
I said rondel.
Walker said rondel. Rondel is one of my absolute favorite mechanisms. And here it's just because of one designer. This is because of Matt Gertz. That is, His games, two of his games are in my top 10 games of all time. And if you include the prior editions of both of those games, effectively it's four. Because if I could include them several times, I would. I'm talking specifically about Imperial, either 2030 or the original version. I prefer the 2030 version, but I would happily play the original one. And indeed, in terms of theming, I prefer it. But in terms of the overall quality of the map, I prefer 2030. And Antica and Antica 2. And just shy of my top 20 is a game called Navigador, which also uses the same rondel. The basic system of his rondel has always been the same. There are eight actions on your rondel. You can move forward to three spaces clockwise. You can't stay on the same space. And you can go further, but you have to pay. Sometimes it's not that expensive. Advancing faster in Navigador and Antica is much less expensive than advancing further in Imperial. And Imperial, you actually have to pay victory points, which is not great. But nonetheless, what you have, therefore, is a certain kind of... And this is going to sound dismissive or like less of a good game design, but I really think it works well. Kind of an implied tempo of the game, an implied tempo of when you do various things. And for beginners, it's very, very easy. It makes sense about the order in which things are done. You get to be kind of onboarded, and it leads to an excellent game flow on top of the very, very quick actions, which is another feature of many rondel games.
Yeah, like for beginners, I'm going to agree with that, because when you're learning a game, especially with a rondel, you can just go one space at a time and learn how to do each action or understand what each action does and then go to town.
Or even just accept the fact that, you know, you're just going to limit yourself to the next three available actions and not worry about the horizons past that while you're getting your legs underneath you. But then you start learning when it is time to be resource inefficient to be time efficient. And you start racing around to those key moments. And honestly, I think in terms of clever action selections, that is leads to clever decision-making while at the same time being super approachable and leading to excellent game flow, the rondel may well be unparalleled, especially as presented by Matt Gaertz. Now, some people prefer what the mechanism that Matt Gaertz also introduced, or at least kind of perfected in a lot of ways, that we call deck management. So your entire hand is your deck. You play cards, and then you play a card to get all your deck back. This is what he did in Concordia. This also happens in another game we like called Aquatica. I don't like this as much. I like it just fine. But to me, it's less clever because it doesn't have a sort of implied geography, spatiality, or ordering to the actions. You can just do them in whatever order you want. And to a certain extent, that gives you more freedom, but at the same time, it doesn't constrain you in the way that I like how the rondel constrains you. So it's a question of taste. But
it's true. I don't like how some games are called rondels when they're like Great Western Trail. Everyone
it's
says
kind
it's
of a rondel.
It is kind of, but I think just the limitations, like you said, the spending more and the limitation of what you can do on the rondel, I think that's what makes it a rondel.
Sure.
In my opinion.
Well, I think that would be... I would agree with you, and then I would say that Matt Gaertz's rondels are better than the rondel in Great Western Trail. Although... In its defense, the rondel in Great Western Trail can be customized, not entirely unlike the way you customize it in Crusaders, because you build more buildings, and that just gums up other people's rondels. Yes. Anyway.
Lastly for me, it's powering up worker actions by adding more workers.
Sure.
Like Crusaders, like I was talking about. You're moving all these cylinders around your rondel, and the more cylinders are there, the more powerful the actions are. Teotihuacan. They call that's a rondel too. You're going around and around.
Absolutely.
Anyway, you're bringing
these
dice. Yeah, depending on the values of the dice, the actions are going to be more powerful. Troll and Princess. Maybe this is why I sort of want to get back to that and play it again. I know you don't like it, but you're
I thought it was fun.
I know it's fun.
I wasn't jazzed.
You're putting castles. You're putting trolls, and the more trolls that are there, the more. And my favorite, Yokohama. You're depositing workers all over the place. The more workers you have there, or the more presence, the more powerful the actions are.
Rites of Wistar, we did that recently.
Yep. Just so. I love that type of system.
Yeah, and we did not like Architects of the West Kingdom, which has kind of the same thing.
Kind of.
The steady... You just don't even want to acknowledge that it has the same element. Because... I agree with you. That if it is the case... that there is a sufficiently robust system of moving your workers around such that it is doable, but not trivial. Like, you have to get the balancing right. If it's too difficult to move your workers around, then you kind of feel stuck doing the same thing over and over again, and you never really are in a position to pivot. But if the overall economy is such that it's doable, but not trivial, well, then you can save up for and plan and shift at the appropriate times. I agree. And finally, for me, this is a huge, huge mechanism. It probably isn't. I'm equating the unequal here, and I fully recognize that. Tile laying. slash tile placement.
Wow.
I do. Okay, look. I'll be more specific. Are you happy?
Rolling dice.
No, shut up. You think you're cute? You think you're clever? Is that it?
My mommy says so.
You think you're bitching? Is that it? Well, you're not. You're nothing but a board game podcaster. Nobody likes those.
Damn it.
So I'm talking specifically about shared board tile laying. A question where you're presented with a more or less blank canvas, and the geography of the game is stipulated almost entirely by the actions of the players. And once again, yes, I'm going to talk about Reiner Knizia. So if you look at his tile-laying quadrilogy, all of them share the same features in that you start with a board that's almost empty, and by the end of the game, you're going to end up with a radically different geography from game to game. A lot of people talk about replayability, and sometimes they use that in shorthand. I do this the same way, for there are lots of different setups, or lots of different player powers, or there are lots of different configurations. You don't necessarily need different configurations. Wabash Cannonball shows that, Through the Desert shows that, Tigris and Euphrates shows that, Stevenson's Rocket shows that. I'm going to put a kind of exception for Samurai, which is in his tiling trilogy, because the geography of Samurai is rather constrained already. You know, it's a narrow map, like some made-up chain of islands, I don't know.
Babylonia as well.
Babylonia, yes. Less a fan of Babylonia than that, but still solid, yes. And ultimately, the way the board looks is just really, really different. So Babylonia, and again, like Samurai, the key elements that you're fighting over are fixed, and so there's less of that freedom. I'm talking primarily about things like at the end of a game of Stevenson's Rocket, you don't know what railroad is going to be the one that went and devoured everything. You don't know how many railroads are going to be active by the end of the game. And so you have this tremendous variety that just emerges organically through the pressures created by the tiling itself. So, same thing with Tigris and Euphrates. If you pay attention to the kinds of kingdoms that rise and fall, the kinds of powers that develop, whether there's a strong element of cooperation or not, these are the things that vary considerably from game to game, exclusively because of the way the tile laying works. And when that happens, I am all over it. I like other tile laying games, you know, Galaxy Trucker I like, Feast for Odin, of course, Gods of Dinosaurs, things of that nature, where you're just playing around with your own board. That's okay, but that's not what I'm talking about in terms of my all-time favorites. And that is a situation where you get that genuine variety. I am going to include Cube Rails games in this category, because I get to include whatever I want. I'm going to call the cubes tiles, and I'm going to say they're the same thing, even though they're a different component. Because you get that same variety. Whether it's Stevenson's Rocket or Wabash Cannonball, you don't know what the board's going to look like at the end of the game. That's what I love. And reacting to those pressures, reacting to those changing situations, that's what you can do with tile laying, and that's what I'm going to emphasize for my favorite mechanisms. I guess what I'm getting at is that I like Reiner Knizia. I've come to this realization about myself.
Really?
Yeah.
Weird.
Be careful. Don't clutch your pearls too harshly.
Okay.
So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We genuinely appreciate your having decided to spend the time with us. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our information at sowronggames.com/contact, and you'll find a whole bunch of other good stuff on sowronggames.com. Walker, why might people want to get in touch with us?
Well, because coming up, Mark, we're going to do another sort of omnibus questionnaire. So go ahead over to our guild, Board Game Geek, or send us an email, or come to our Facebook group, or if you're on our Discord, I will have a channel there for it. Ask whatever questions you'd like, and on an upcoming episode, we'll answer all of those questions.
No topic is off limits, but we won't necessarily answer all the questions that we think might get us in trouble.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.